The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, and Chicago. And if you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Tim McKenna.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Tim.
How are you?
I am really excellent. It's a little fall-like today.
Yeah, but that's because it's, you know, tomorrow is September already.
True that. And it's supposed to be like 90 degrees, so who knows? It's Cleveland!
It won't snow, I can guarantee that.
That's true. So I want to make a real quick mention of the earthquake in Napa, because we have some really good friends up there, some who actually own vineyards, and we hope that all are safe and well. As for the loss of all that wine?
Yep.
Yeah, well, hang your head and cry. Sigh. We are going to take a few moments to fill you in on the upcoming Ride for Miles. As most of us here in Northeast Ohio know, Dr. Miles Coburn was a very much respected and loved professor of biology here at John Carroll. He was an avid cyclist, an environmentalist, and unfortunately, he was killed in a bike crash back in 2008. The entire school and cycling community came together that year to honor Miles with an impromptu ride. Just a couple weeks after, a whole bunch of people showed up just to show their respect and to honor him. That's grown into the organized Ride for Miles, which now in its seventh year takes place next Saturday. Miles' brother Chris is with us from Boston to tell us about this year's event. After we speak with Chris, we're going to talk cyclocross. And when we talk cyclocross, there isn't a more dominant and exciting figure in the sport than Katie Compton. Amassing 22 World Cup wins, 4 medals at the Cyclocross World Championships, as well as 90-plus UCI wins, Katie Compton is the most successful U.S. cyclocross athlete, male or female, in the sport. This evening, we're going to find out what makes Katie Compton, or KFC, as she is affectionately known, although the F is, yeah, we can't use that word on the air. She's such a great competitor, one of our most treasured U.S. cyclists. After a short break and a bit of news, we're going to head on down to our state capital, Columbus, Ohio. Tim, do you know what placemaking is?
No, I don't.
Do you want to know?
Yes.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So placemaking is defined as a multifaceted approach to the planning, design, and management of neighborhoods and public spaces. Placemaking is both a process and a philosophy. And if you love your very own special, unique, great place and work hard to maximize its uniqueness, you're a placemaker.
Okay. So
all right.
In Cleveland, when it's on the river, we have all kinds of placemaking going on with
exactly.
The good stuff that we have there.
Exactly. Although we haven't focused much on advocacy this summer, that's all about to change. We're going to speak with the director of the Placemaker Lab. His name is Matt Shad. The lab is a 3.5-day workshop that's going to be taking place in Columbus, Ohio's German Village in the middle of September. The topics for the workshop range from walkability, art, retail, to aging, transit, and parking. Finally, we're going to talk about an event that rivals any amateur ride or race anywhere, the Road Titans 300-plus Cycling Challenge. This may or may not be up our alley. You just might want to get your low gears on and head down to Oconee County, South Carolina. It's 3 days of riding, climbing, and what promises to be one hell of an event. I'm telling you, I've never heard of anything quite like this. We're going to talk with the ride directors, Jan Michael Ramery and Jonathan Strauss, to find out all the nitty-gritty details. And since the ride isn't until mid-November, you have plenty of time to train.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Packed show, yep. So let's giddy up and head on over to Boston. We're going to speak with Chris Coburn about this year's Ride for Miles. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclists. It's time for Ride for Miles.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So tell us a little bit about this year's ride. Of course, it's really about the legacy that your brother left with both John Carroll and the cycling community and the environmental community.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the seventh year. First year we did it was just a few weeks after the accident, so it was pretty impromptu. We've become better organized over the years. We expect about 350 to 400 riders on a 15-mile course going from John Carroll out to Gates Mills and back.
Well, it is a beautiful course, and what's really cool is we don't have to stop for stop signs and stoplights on this ride.
Yes, and lots of law enforcement folks on the course as well as many volunteers. It's a fun family event, lots of food and music, and a little bit of riding.
Right, exactly. It's not as much about the, well, we all know that we ride to eat, so what's the point? Right, exactly. So tell us the date of the ride and the time and the website.
Sure. It's September 7th, 10 a.m. is the kickoff time, so we encourage people who aren't pre-registered to come by 9. Ideally, folks will register ahead of time. The website is rideformiles.org. That's all one word, rideformiles.org. And we begin and end at John Carroll in front of the Dolan Science Center, which is where Miles taught and where his home department biology is located.
Is there going to be a symposium on the environment this year?
Well, yeah. What happened at John Carroll is they actually created an endowed chair in Miles' name, and they have recruited a new faculty member to fill that, the inaugural chair. So that's really the focus at this time. And we've been supporting that with the fundraising. The focus of the chair is environmental sciences both from a teaching standpoint, but also within the John Carroll community.
Well, Chris, I look forward to seeing you next week. We'll be encouraging, of course, people to go to rideformiles.org and signing up. And have a safe trip back, and we'll see you on the road.
Thank you, Diane, and thanks again to all your listeners.
Oh, thank you. Bye-bye.
See you later.
Okay, bye-bye. Chris Coburn joined me from vacation. That was kind of nice that he took some time from vacation to talk with me.
Yeah, considering all the, you know, short time that he does get for being on vacation. And
yeah.
It's kind of tough. You'd have trouble getting me away from lobster.
You're riding, aren't you?
Yes, I'm all signed up, ready to go.
There you go. All right. Well, we are going to just take a moment here, and then we are going to head right on over to Colorado Springs to speak with probably one of the coolest athletes on the planet. Just give us 30 seconds. We'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Good evening, Katie. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I did a lot of research, and you are quite the cyclist, I would say. You have 22 World Cup wins, 4 medals at Cyclocross Worlds, 90-plus UCI wins. It's amazing. So let's back up and talk about your background and how you got into cycling a little bit.
I've started riding my bike when I was young. My dad was a bike racer. My mom was a marathoner, so I came from an active family. But I started riding my bike early, and then I think I started racing when I was about 8. Doing street sprints. My dad put on bike races, and he put on like a Thursday night racing series, like local racing series. So I did that, and I was just good at it. I liked to race my bike. I liked riding. I'd go out for training rides with my dad. I was good at it fairly quickly. But then again, I rode my bike a ton too when I was a kid, so I'm sure that helped. And then when I was about 11 or 12, I went to Trexlertown, PA for just to train on the velodrome there and start track racing. And I spent my junior years racing track and road, did junior national racing and junior worlds a couple times. And I just kind of got hooked to bike racing. It's a fun sport to do and good group of people. And I think kept me from getting in trouble, too.
It does have a way of doing that. That's so true. So put that into context time-wise. What years were you racing juniors at Trexlertown?
It was, I think, probably 92 is when I started. So it was 92 through probably 97 is when I was racing.
Wow. Then what happened?
I just kind of took a little bit of a break. I went to college, and you know that transition from junior to elite is always a tough one.
Right.
You know, it's a big jump from being really good as a junior to being pack fodder as an elite, you know?
Yeah. It's a come down in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I wasn't that bad. Like I did well in certain races. I was a crit racer and better on flat circuits for sure. But college, it's a nice transition, and I was kind of enjoying as I got on the mountain bike. So I was, found a different group of friends who, you know, weren't track racers. So I started mountain biking a lot more and did some mountain bike racing and kind of just took a break away from the intensity and the serious racing, I'll say.
So then how did you get from track racing and then some of the road stuff you did to working with this blind stoker and getting into the Paralympics? We're going to talk about your cross, you know, career, of course, but this is an interesting part for me.
Yeah, this was actually getting on the Paralympic team. That kind of renewed my love for bike racing, got my fitness, you know, improved my fitness quite a bit and just got me mentally in a better place. Like I had, so I took the 4.5 year program for college, took a semester off to race in Europe, which was a negative experience, I'll say. But I came back and I had to do an internship to finish my degree in exercise science. So I was at the University of Delaware there, and then I found a coaching internship in Colorado Springs with Carmichael Training Systems. So I moved out to Colorado, working on at CTS, coaching, and doing the internship. And one of the coaches I was working with, he was coaching the Paralympic team, and he knew my background. He was national team coach and track coach for quite a bit of time, I think in the 90s and early 2000s. And he just asked me if I wanted to try the tandem. And mentioned like it's a possibility of the Paralympics and, you know, European championships, world championships on the tandem. And so I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? Sounds fun. And I gave it a try. And the stoker and I, we meshed really well and just rode well together. And I just realized how much fun the tandem was. It's totally different. The racing was different. Events were different. Tandem is totally different. And I just kind of fell into it.
I'm a tandem stoker, so I know. I love it. You know, I love it.
Different type of speed. I miss the speed. Like, you can't get that on a single bike.
True. True. I'm not sure I'd want to do what we do on a tandem on a single bike. I don't know.
I know.
It's terrifying when you think about it. I'm speaking with Katie, and we're not going to say it, but it's Effin Compton, and she is a phenomenon. Affectionately known as KFC, has nothing to do with chicken whatsoever. So
no.
I had a question about the UCI rules and why you were not allowed to enter any races that awarded UCI points while you were doing Paralympics. What is that? I don't understand how that rule works.
Well, it was mainly a rule set up to keep pros away from jumping on the tandem and racing, you know, in amateur events.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It wasn't perfectly, you know, cut and dry that way because UCI events, you know, it's not just a professional. It's a lot of amateur racing, you know, UCI events as well. But it was just a way to keep the professional riders who are racing for a pro team and UCI team or getting UCI points from, you know, jumping on a tandem before the event and being able to, you know, be maybe a stronger partner of the two.
Ah, that makes sense.
I think it's like you need a year off the tandem, or I mean, I'm sorry, a year racing like on a like UCI team or UCI points or national team racing before you can be a tandem pilot.
Got it. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, once you were finished with the Paralympics, and you did take home a lot of medals.
We did. Actually, when we rode raced together. We raced really well. We won 4 medals in Athens. We set a world record in the pursuit. We won 2 gold. So Athens was a great experience for us. The pursuit, our final pursuit ride, is my favorite effort I think I've ever put in on the bike. It just felt so good. It's one of those efforts where you're suffering, but you're suffering and getting faster and faster and faster. And it just felt really good on that last ride. And I haven't had a pursuit feel that good, I think, ever. So for it to come together on, like, you know, at Athens is pretty cool.
What's your ex-tandem partner doing now? Do you know? Do you keep in touch?
No, actually, we are completely polar opposites. So technically, we didn't really get along off the bike or on the bike, to be honest. We're just totally different. And we rode well together, but it got to that point where we weren't getting along very well and we weren't riding well together. And it was, you know, we'd won everything we needed to win and I could race cross. And so we kind of just like mutual separation there. But she's still racing. She has had a variety of pilots. I think she and I are still the most successful together. But she's still in it. She still enjoys riding the bike and racing. And, you know, I think her next race is probably World Championships in Greenville coming up.
Well, that's good. Good. Well, good for her. And so that was a good segue. We're going to talk about cyclocross. My first question to you about cyclocross is, why did you choose cyclocross as your discipline? I know you're great at it, but you didn't know that with your first race. Well, actually, maybe you did. So what was it about cyclocross that sucked you right in?
Honestly, I think cyclocross chose me. Growing up racing track, I have the speed and the ability to get the intensity and go hard, but also for mountain biking, growing up riding the mountain bike, I think that helped the technical part too. And so the combination of the two have been good, but I've just always been good at racing cross. It's just something that kind of came natural to me. I've always been good at riding on the dirt, riding on the mud, kind of riding over rough, grassy, like dirt road terrain type stuff. But I also love it. I love the intensity of it. I love the fact that it's dynamic. It's never boring. It's a short enough race where you can just go full gas from, you know, start to finish. But you have the technical aspect, you have the fitness aspect, and then you also have the, you know, the stair sprints and the little bit of running and on and off the bike. So I don't get bored. So I kind of like the variety and I like the intensity of it.
You know, it's also a reasonably good spectator sport.
It's a really good spectator sport, I have to say. I think of all bike racing, it's the most spectator friendly.
Yeah, because you can get close to the riders. You can also get dirty, which is kind of cool. But you don't have to sit in a stadium and watch a track. And you certainly on the road are not going to see anybody more than once every, even on a circuit race, it's every 5 miles or 6 miles. So, yeah, it's kind of a cool event. I assume you were in Louisville.
I was. Yeah, Louisville was crazy. It was amazing. Like, I don't think I've ever had cheers that loud all the way around the course nonstop. Like, I couldn't hear myself breathe, which is probably good. So I was suffering quite a bit.
Once again, I'm speaking with world-class cyclocross. Actually, I will quote this, the most successful U.S. cyclocross athlete, male or female, in the sport, Katie Compton. I want to talk a little bit about your physical one issue, cramping. A lot of us go through this. A lot of men go through this. And I guess it was leg issues you were having. And many of us can relate to it. So are they mostly under control, the cramping issues? And do you know what was the underlying cause? Have you been able to resolve those issues?
No, I haven't. It's something I manage. I actually manage it fairly well. I definitely have, I usually have a bad episode once every 12 to 18 months. So I think it's been about 14 months since I had an episode. I had one last summer. I manage it well. It's never going to go away, but as long as I manage the training and the intensity, and then as long as I get plenty of sleep, fatigue is a huge factor in it, as well as intensity and rest days. So it's definitely not normal cramping like you'd get from like electrolyte imbalance or, you know, some sort of different imbalance in the body with like hydration or dehydration or whatever. I don't know what it is. I just try to manage the symptoms. And when I feel like something's coming on, I just back it off. I take recovery days, like active recovery days. I do some long, easy pedaling and just kind of warm the body without really pushing hard. That seems to help. And then I just have to be careful with the travel. I have to manage the travel sure. around the race too, and not do too much without enough sleep. So it's a different feeling. It's like it's kind of hard pain to describe. Cause it's more of like a burning, like someone's twisting a hot knife in the muscle type feeling instead of a cramping. So
interesting.
It's funny though, because I've been in the media with this and have like issues and I missed races because of it, and I've had quite a few athletes approach me for similar issues where it's not just normal cramping, but it's intense leg pains in the quads. So I think more people suffer from it. I just don't think the physiology has been studied well enough to know exactly what's going on.
I actually have somebody who might know what's going on.
Yeah?
Yes, I do. And we'll talk about that and when we're off air. But yes, I do. Okay. Anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about Marianne Vos.
Yes.
So she is the current world champion, and I am sure that is a race you want to win.
Of course.
So, and I know that you have this sort of friendly rivalry with her. I have never spoken with her, but it seems to me, boy, she's the girl to beat. Yes?
Yes, she is. I love racing as Marianne, to be honest. She's fun to race with because she's like the only one who like matches my every move. And it's fun when we're racing together. Like, we break the same time, we take the same lines, we shift the same time, we accelerate the same. It's funny like how similar we are when we're racing against each other. And I think I noticed that mainly in when we were racing together at the Rome World Cup this past year, is like trying to think of when I can attack and like when I can put her under pressure, and like we were doing everything at the same time. So it was kind of fun because we get to push each other, but it's also a certain rhythm to it, which I really like. But she, you know, she's also such an amazing competitor, and she's just strong and she's respectful. And you know, when I beat her, I know I've had a great day.
Yeah,
you know?
No kidding.
It's one of those lights, like, oh, that feels good.
Yeah, well, you know, and everybody watches her, so I imagine, where are Worlds this year?
They're in Tábor, Czech Republic. So it's about an hour and a half outside of Prague.
And when will they occur?
February? Usually last weekend in January or February 1st.
Right. Okay.
It's usually Super Bowl Sunday.
You know, you're the athlete and we are the viewers, we are the fans. Do you think cyclocross can be, will be, is going to be as popular as, say, Tour de France, the big stage races, the Vuelta, anything? Do you think that it could be the television racing phenomenon? I mean, right now, everything's being televised on the roadside.
Yeah, I think it does. I just think it has to develop a little bit more. In the U.S., it's huge in Belgium. Like, cross season starts, and that's what everybody focuses on pretty much October through February.
Hmm.
It's getting there, I think, domestic, and it's kind of getting, the fan base is growing, the racers are growing. It's fun to watch. It's exciting to watch. But I think in the U.S., we just need more cameras on the ground. Like, that's usually the biggest issue with our U.S. coverage is there's one or two cameras and you miss half the race unless you're there. So I think, you know, more cameras would help. But yeah, I think it's definitely growing. And I think, I don't know if it'll ever get to the level of the road race, because people, there's so much history and culture and kind of, people kind of romanticize road racing. They love watching it, even though it's better, way better to watch on TV with cameras than it is to stand by the side of the road.
Sure.
Yeah. Come by
for 30 seconds. Yeah. 5 seconds is probably more like it.
I mean, the caravan is 2 minutes and the Peloton just whoops by and that's it. So I think it's a different, I don't want to say different spectators, but people just love road racing, I think, because everybody can do it. Anybody can get on a road bike and ride it, whereas cross bike, it takes a little bit more skill. Mountain bike takes a lot more skill. And I think people like road racing because they can relate to it a little bit easier, maybe.
Possibly. Tell me a little bit about your bike. Now, you are now a Trek Factory team racer, which, congratulations, that's a pretty big step.
Thanks.
Tell me about your bike. Is it a carbon bike?
Yep, I'm riding the new Boone cyclocross bike. It's carbon. It's got the ISO speed technology, which is kind of like compression dampener, I guess, for like on the seat stay. It kind of takes the edge off the ride, kind of makes it a little smoother. That decoupler is in the Damani version, which is like the classics version of their road bike that Fabian Consolera helped develop, and then I helped with the Boone. So yeah, it's just the cross Pacific bike we've been working on for the last year and a half or so. And it pretty much, it's the perfect bike. It rides over the rough stuff well. It handles great on a single track. It's a light bike. It feels good. It just makes you smile when you ride it. And I think that's my favorite part about it. I just ride my bike. I don't think about it. It's just fun.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, if you're not having fun, why are you doing that?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's one of those things, you just jump on the bike and it kind of rides itself. It's predictable. And I actually enjoy riding it in single track the most. Like what I call vanilla single track, where it's not technical, but it's twisty, turny technical. And you can just like rip around turns and it's just a fun bike to ride.
How long do you think you're going to keep racing? How many more seasons? Do you have a goal, or are you just letting it slide?
You know, I get that question. People ask me that question quite a bit. Well, because I'm 35. I think my racing age is like 37, which it annoys me to see. But like I'm 35 and I just want to keep racing as long as I'm riding well. I love racing. I love the travel. It's a fun job to have, and I still enjoy it. So as long as I'm riding well, I'm going to keep doing it. As long as I'm healthy.
Yeah.
Trek's been awesome. So I just signed another 2-year contract with them. And I'm going to, I think every 2 years I'm kind of reassess and see where I am and see kind of where I am motivational wise. But I want to keep doing it. I don't want to have kids. So I think that makes it easier as a woman. I think kids is usually what is a determining factor on when women retire.
Right.
You know, we've got a small window there.
When will you leave for training in Europe?
October. There are 2 World Cups in October, the end of it. So I'll go over there for that. But then I'll come back and race a few races here in November. And then about Thanksgiving, I'll go over there and spend more time. I'll just kind of stay over there for like the long haul through cross worlds. Obviously coming home for nationals, but I'll just do a quick trip home for that. But yeah, once I'm in Belgium in November, I'll try to stay, and I'll go down to Mallorca for training when I can, just to see the sun and have a change of pace, change of scenery. But yeah, it's all, once I start in September, pretty much full gas through worlds.
It's just great to be able to talk to you. You know, the successes are just unbelievably glowing. They're awesome. It's wonderful to talk with somebody who is doing so well at such an elite level and yet is so down to earth. I have one more question, and I always ask women who come on the show and talk with me, and that is, do you believe that eventually there will be parity in women for racing? Will they be paid the way men will be paid?
I hope so. I think it will develop to more equality as the years go by. It's a slow process. It's slower than I want it to be. It probably isn't going to happen in my career as a cyclist, but I hope it happens in, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, it gets more equal. In the whole world of just being a woman in general, like whether in sport or, in the corporate world, women still get paid less. And I think we're making small progress year to year, but it's just something that takes time and not something that's going to happen overnight. So I think this year with La Course happening at the Tour for the women, that was a huge step, and that was equal prize money for that stage. So that was major in, the development of, women's cycling, as well as bringing up the equality. It takes time, and I know there's UCIs trying to push for it, and we just have to kind of change the old school generation of their logic and the fact that they don't feel like women can do sport.
Yeah. Well, you sure have disproved that one, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. And exactly. It's just, I mean, women are good endurance athletes. We're really strong, and we usually do better at endurance sports. So, I mean, tennis took a long time to turn around. I think Billie Jean King started, in the 70s, pushing for equality, and it's 2014, and, how many years later was that? 44 years or whatever?
Yeah, somewhere in there, yeah. Billie Jean did smash that ball across that net.
She did, and she worked really hard to make those changes. So I think, we have some women like that here in cycling, and I think it'll eventually get there, but it's going to take some time. And I hope I see it. I hope it gets to that point.
Me too. Me too. Well, Katie, it's just been a pleasure to speak with you. And I wish you a lot of luck this coming season. And stay on the road. Well, you know what we say, rubber side down.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, you take care.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Katie Compton joined me from her home in Colorado Springs, Colorado. As you heard, she'll be heading over to Europe to begin the cross season over there, looking for a world championship this year. We're going to take a break, and we will be right back with the second half of our show. You are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees.
And I'm Tim McKenna.
And we have some news for you today. What you got, Tim?
Lots of news, but let's do automotive news.
Hey!
All right. So GM has launched a bike share program for 19,000 employees at its Warren Technical Center.
Who?
GM.
Oh, GM.
General Motors. It'll help them navigate the 61 buildings on 330-acre campus and provide convenient transportation for errands in the surrounding community. Here's their statement. GM is investing not only in the long-term health and productivity of its workforce, but sending a strong message to other employers around the country that bike sharing is a mainstream transportation option for its employees. I think that's really neat.
I think so, too. That's very special.
But here's the interesting thing about the bikes.
Yeah.
They can reach 20 miles an hour using a drivetrain and a 600-watt motor and a 48-volt battery.
So really, they're just GM products,
more or less. They're electricing their way around.
Got it.
But it's good to see that they've got the bicycles out.
I think it's cool. So the most talked about event this past week was the Emmys. Did you watch the Emmys?
Of course not.
Of course not. Well, the Emmys had a little pre-show excitement, and our friend Patrick Brady got to participate in it from Red Kite Prayer. This is pretty cool. The headliner, though, was writer Tom Smuts, who happens to be a cyclist. When cycling makes the Hollywood Reporter, we've arrived.
Yes.
Yes. So this is written by somebody named Austin Sigmund Broca. What's an Emmy nominee to do about downtown traffic on awards night Monday? Well, one could limo pool, depart at 2:30 p.m. or use the valet at a nearby hotel, or hail an Uber or brave freeway gridlock like an average commuter. And then there's Tom Smuts' way. Bike it. The writer, who is nominated for Outstanding Drama Series with the rest of the producers of Mad Men's 7th season, will lead a 15-person bike ride to the awards ceremony. The Television Academy has granted permission for 6 of the riders to cycle up to the carpet, a group that includes Smuts' wife, Homeland executive producer and 2-time Emmy winner Meredith Stein. The route will run 17 miles from their Santa Monica home to the Nokia Theater in about an hour and a half, Smuts says. And forget the spandex. He will arrive in bike-friendly evening attire produced by, who do you think? Rafa.
Of course.
Of course. They've got, you know, bike attire for your evening wear at the Emmys.
Yes.
So I thought that was pretty cool.
Okay, some U.S. Pro Cycling Challenge news. This year, the overall winner was TJ Van Garderen.
Yay!
Last stage was won by Garmin Sharp rider Alex Howes. One of the neat things was Taylor Finney hopped on a bike and rode up to the start during call-ups at stage 7.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool to know that he's back on a bike, even though he can't race
just
yet.
The fact that he's on a bike and showing off all his scars and all the good stuff, it was really nice to see him.
Dig scars,
yeah,
right?
It was really good to see him back up there.
That's good.
On a sad note, during the race, Ian Crane, he had a small crash, had to change his bike. And he was actually coming back up through the caravan and ran into the back of the Cannondale car, smashed into the windshield with his face. due to all of the, and let's not be graphic, but just
too late,
a lot of blood loss,
right,
because of all the cuts and the abrasions and everything, there was actually consideration of halting the race at that time. But
right,
after they realized much of it was surface, they did have to life flight him to the hospital. And the latest update that I saw through a journal on Caring Bridge, which we've seen other journals in there. If you go to Caring Bridge, you can just do a search for him and you can see it. As of Wednesday, they had removed a breathing tube and he was doing much better.
That's good. Good to know. Do you have one more?
Yeah, just one real quick thing. This weekend,
go right ahead.
We have the last in the series of the U.S. National Criterium races. It's the gatewaycup.com, if you go to their website, gatewaycup.com, which they're holding 4 days. The last 2 days, today and Sunday, they're going to have live streamed the races that are going on. And again, here's another great news about this. Both pro men and pro women categories will compete for equal prize money.
Yay!
$26,000 per gender.
Well, so much for the news. We are going to head on down to our state capitol.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to talk about the Great Placemakers Lab with Matt Shadd, the director. Matt, thank you for joining us on the show this evening.
Thank you, Diane. It's a pleasure being with you today.
The Great Placemakers Lab is coming up in a couple of weeks, and I want to know what your definition of placemaker is, and then we'll learn a little bit about you and what this whole lab is going to be about.
Okay. Almost self-defined. Now, it's a mixture of practice and belief is what I believe placemaking is. So I'm an old urban planner. Dad was a civil engineer, and I drew towns since I was about third grade. So city planning stuff's always been my blood. And implementing and getting things done is even more important than planning. And I feel like, and I think what we've been doing with this lab that we're working on, is that we're trying to talk about a way of improving community. And I think from that, there's a couple key components that are about placemaking. Typically, I think if you stop and ask yourself which communities tend to do well at what they do and are considered communities you want to be in, usually you see a couple key themes. You see that the community has some sense of authenticity. It knows what it is and what it wants to be. Usually it's a very engaged public and tends to work from the grassroots level, where people start from the bottom and kind of form a sense of what they want and where they want to go, and they bring that up. It's not necessarily a top-down type of project anymore. Third, I think, in the same sense with projects, a lot of times the best communities start with small incremental projects and build upon them. And because of those levels of wins and success, you continue to have ownership and engagement from the people who are, again, formulating the ideas. And that's probably the three cores. I know there's a couple other things we tend to do and think about, but I think that's got a lot to do with it. There's a lot of people in the public these days that are using the word placemaking. And again, to me, that's where I feel my definition is and how we try to form the lab that we're talking about today.
That makes perfect sense. So your relationship to the Placemaker Lab, you are the director. You're the one who's actually putting this event together.
Yes, I was asked to do this by the German Village Society. This is a neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio, one of the country's oldest historic designated communities, about a 50-year-old national historic neighborhood. Until just recently, I've been a resident of that neighborhood and part of the community in that area. And so when we were talking about it from the German Village Society's perspective, I said I would be happy to take on the task.
German Village is really a cool little area of Columbus. So if anybody is listening and is going to go through our state capital, Columbus, Ohio, I would think a stop in German Village would be almost mandatory because it's such a cool little area of Columbus.
It is, and it actually was. I don't think we realized it when we started this planning, but it actually espouses 100% of what placemaking was. For those of you ever thinking about it, is Columbus's number one tourist destination. And you can always check it out at germanvillage.com.
So. I can absolutely believe that. So tell us about the actual event and when it's going to happen.
Okay. So the event is going to be from September 16th, that's a Tuesday night, through Friday, September 19th. So it's a 3.5-day program. It's looking at it. At our program, you actually can participate in as little as a half a day. There are some pieces that can be participated in at that short a period, and we have people doing that, as well as the full comp race. But we tend to have a couple different things going on each day, and if you want, I can always go into that in detail, Diane, just depending on how you want to frame the conversation.
We will talk about the breakout sessions in a moment. I do want to talk about your plenary speaker, Jeff Speck. We've had him on the show. He's really an interesting guy. How'd you run into him?
Being an old urban planner, I've been a part of the APA my whole career, and actually I'm considered a certified planner as well at the credentialing system. So we've been actually talking about bringing Jeff Speck into Columbus before on other occasions, and so when this opportunity came up and he graciously accepted, we were eager to have him in because we feel he brings one of those key aspects to placemaking, which we do believe some of the elements of walkability and multimodal transportation, whenever it can be provided, and the physical environment that that usually come with those, which can usually include density and more public spaces and public gathering, are all very important. And so what we're hoping he'll do when he comes is give us a little look at Columbus and give us a sense of what he's seeing in Columbus, as well as just kind of preaching the good walkability mandate, I think is our title for his plenary lunch. He's also going to actually work through the afternoon. So not only will he have the plenary session, participants can actually sit through almost two extra hours with him, where he's going to talk more specific techniques and practices.
Very cool. I'm speaking with Matt Shedd. He is the director of the Great Placemakers Lab that is coming up mid-September in Columbus, Ohio. Who's going to attend this workshop? Who either has been invited or who is interested and coming together to make some of these breakout sessions happen?
Attendance-wise, we're actually getting a very broad spectrum, Diane, and that was very intentional. One of the principles that our committee had when organizing this is we really wanted to talk about breaking down silos. So often urban planners, architects, landscape architects, people in development communities, and actually, quite frankly, community activists and neighborhood people that are driving things are always sitting in shells and silos, excuse me. So our point was to really invite all of them, because really for good placemaking and good community building, you really need everybody to come to the table and bring their skills and passions together. Our mix is actually that broad. We do have a little bit of many of the professional organizations. We've also had a number of Main Street organizations signing up, some community activist groups and some parent organizations, and that's partly because a couple of our tracks actually focus on people building skills, not just necessarily physical planning opportunities and techniques.
So far, how many people are signed up? Do you know?
We started off a little slow, but we're on track right now. We have capacity for up to 300 people on every given day. We aren't quite there yet, but we are happy to report we're ready and willing. And we just had our attendance just ran up a third this week. We had a strong registration week.
Everybody always waits till the last minute. You know how that goes.
Oh, I know. It scared me to death, too. So it's been a real pleasure to see that coming through. But it's been interesting and a good mix. And again, it's not just Columbus. We do have, I'll call it a regional representation so far, both not only from some of our speakers, but as well as where our registrants are coming from. I would say most of them are within an easy drive, the couple-hour radius around Columbus. But we're very pleased that we're getting a mix of people from other metro areas as well.
So what are you hoping to achieve at the end of the 3 days? What is it that you want to get out of this particular workshop or let your attendees get out of it?
Well, I think the point was with a lot of what we tried to pick is, I would say, skill building and just learning some techniques as well as kind of sharing with your brethren. So often the people that do this kind of work are working alone or are working within, your neighborhood context. And so often when you come outside the neighborhood, you may find that there's some other people with good ideas, things that can be shared. I don't know that we want to say copied, because then that's kind of in against the grain with the authenticity question. But to take something and see what other people's successes and failures are and evaluate them against what you could be doing at home. So it's really about skills building as well as a networking of the brethren is our goal.
Great. So the last thing I want to talk about is this APA credit. If you're a member of the American Planning Association, you get a credit for coming to this workshop. What is that credit good for?
Well, again, and it's not just the American Planning Association. It's the American Institute of Architects as well as the American Society of Landscape Architects. So most of us have continuing education credit requirements to maintain our certifications and so forth. If you were to participate in the entire program, there are 20 hours of programming that can account towards your accreditation. Honestly, that's almost, for most of us, almost a 2 years worth in 1 week that you can earn your minimum requirement. So what we have, all of these courses have been approved by all of those accreditation agencies. So we're all ready to go, and they're all considered professional worthy.
Wow, that's great. You do not have to be a member of one of these organizations to attend, though, right?
Oh, absolutely not.
Okay.
In fact, we've had some, quite a few neighborhood, community, passionate people. And I will give a shout out particularly to the Columbus Foundation. Who's been encouraging and in some cases helping some of our neighborhood activists come to the conference through scholarships. So we're very excited that some of the philanthropy foundations have found that this is an appropriate and worthy topic to be discussed.
This becomes sort of a template for this kind of workshop. Will you be taking this workshop outside of the Columbus area?
I'm not sure yet. When we discussed it originally, German Village Society was hoping to maybe replicate it on a biannual basis. I know we'll probably evaluate it after we're done to see if we all have the energy to do it again.
Yeah.
But like I said, we've been so pleased with the diversity of who's speaking and the mix of topics and where they've come from. Our speaker list is pretty broad. We have folks from Long Beach and Atlanta, up in Michigan, South Carolina, Arizona,
nice.
Washington, D.C. So we've got an interesting array of folks that were very eager to come participate. And at least this week, we have eager people that I know are coming to my event. So I'm hoping that the energy will overflow and we'll repeat.
Yeah, it's always nice to throw a party and have people show up.
Yes. As an old party planner, I've done these before. Yeah, it's good to know that your product was what people were interested in.
Tell our listeners how they can find out about the Great Placemaker Lab event.
It's very easy. So the website we have is greatplacemakers.org. And you can find out all the information, the tracks, bios of the speakers and summaries of the breakout, as well as all the registration information.
And will you be offering some sort of wrap-up publication at the end or something that somebody could go back and say, this is what happened?
We were intending for the audience and involved. We were intending to make sure all of the slides and projections are available. There's still a chance we may be able to videotape some pieces. We have some speakers that have at least given us permission, so that's with a question mark at the moment. But some of them are good enough. I would love to have that available. But at this moment, I'll say I'm not sure.
Well, Matt, thank you so much. Good luck. I'm sure you have a lot of work to do over the next couple of weeks to get ready. Again, it's the Great Placemakers.org if you're interested in a planning workshop that sort of makes your community all better. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Diane, it was a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Matt Shad joined me from his office in Columbus, Ohio. Want to be a better placemaker?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the neat thing is the importance of the authenticity. You can't just make a cookie cutter design and drop it down anywhere.
No, you cannot. And German Village is cute. I mean, it's a nice little area of Columbus, and they have won a huge number of awards for what they do down there. All right, we are going to head down to Miami.
And talk about...
Talk about South Carolina.
Where we can work off all the food that we talk about in the rest of the show.
Let's welcome Jen, Michael Ramory, and Jonathan Strauss to the Outspoken Cyclist. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me this evening.
Hey, how are you, Dan?
I'm great. I am just great. I'm excited to talk about your event. Let's introduce you guys. Jen, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll ask Jonathan to introduce himself and tell us about himself, too.
Hey, how are you? Well, my name is Jean-Michel Rameri. I'm an event producer and a cyclist.
Jonathan, what about you?
I'm Jonathan Strauss, and I like to think of myself as an unorthodox marketing guy. I've always tried to push the limits in terms of what we create and how we create it and have fun with it. All about lifestyle, all about outdoor sports, everything like that and the such.
And where are you, Jonathan? I know I'm Jen Michael, you're down in South Carolina, yes?
No, I'm in Miami.
Oh, you are? Oh, even better. And what about you, Jonathan? Where are you?
We're both based in Miami.
Let's talk about Road Titans 300 Plus Challenge and get some details. I know the event isn't until November, so everybody's going to have time to train, right?
You're running out of time now if you decide you're going to start training today, but yeah, you still have some time.
All right, tell us a little bit about the event, what it is and when it is, and then why it's very different from any other event that I've heard about. It's got a really unique concept.
The event is on November 7th through the 9th in Oconee County, South Carolina. Both John Michael and I, when we came up with the concept, wanted to figure out a sport, push the limits of something, create something parallel to that Spartan death race type atmosphere. John Michael being a huge cyclist and enthusiast for the sport himself, we decided to create something with cycling. And so we wanted to make the ultimate challenge, the hardest, most difficult thing that you could imagine in the U.S. And we came up with the concept of Road Titans 300. We want people to become titans. I mean, if you can accomplish 300 miles over 3 days in the mountains and the setting that Oconee County and the uphills of South Carolina provide, you're in for it and you deserve that credit. So we're excited to introduce this event.
So explain the format of the event, because it's the format that is, you know, people will say, well, I could ride 100 miles a day and I can climb and I can do all that. But the format is not what people think. It's not like a mass start and everybody starts going. Explain how you've got your format set up.
All right. Well, we set up the three formats. Well, it's the three pelotons. We set it up as a professional type atmosphere for the cycling enthusiast, you know. So we've developed pelotons. We're going to have different leaders of the different packs, each pack in a different speed limit, and so it is a challenge. It's not a race. There are components of a race throughout it, but we want to give people that atmosphere, that Tour de France type atmosphere, you know. So they're going to get to go in groups that are their same speed so that they can continue to ride in a pack. And they're going to be able to have their stops at the rest stops where they'll get taken care of with good food, good hydration, good support. And then they'll arrive at the destination with their larger pack, per se.
Are they going to be led out at these speeds? How are they going to seed themselves? Are they going to, like, when they sign up, say, I ride an average of 21 to 23 miles an hour, or I ride an average of 15 to 18 miles an hour? Are they going to, like, give themselves the peloton they want to be associated with?
Yes. Yeah, so they sign up for the one that they think they're up to. Obviously, everybody always signs up with the concept that they're the man and they can do it, or they're the greatest, and so they're going to be in the elite pack. After day one, we'll probably find out who the true elite cyclists are, because you're going to climb over 30,000 feet throughout the 3 days, and you're going to be riding uphill more than downhill, that's for sure.
Wow. So we are speaking with Jan Michael Ramirez?
Ramirez, yes.
And Jonathan Strauss, the originators of this amazing Road Titans 300 Plus Challenge that's coming up in November. Tell us a little bit about the venue. You're starting in one city and you're going to end up back in that city. Is that the way it's going to work?
Yes, we start in Oconee County in Seneca, South Carolina, which is the neighboring town to the famous Clemson University. We take that 110 miles through the hills or 100 miles or so into Greenville, South Carolina, which is one of the larger cities in South Carolina. And it's a beautiful town at that. You roam through hills and see amazing waterfalls and an unbelievable scenery, like better than you could have pictured in any destination in the country. You ride into Greenville on that Friday night. We rest in Greenville. On the Saturday morning, we wake up early and head to Pickens County, which Pickens is home of Clemson University. So everybody's going to go back through these amazing vistas and climbs through Cedar's Head and other great iconic landmarks that people hear in the cycling world. And you'll end up in Clemson at Clemson University. There's a great basketball game that night. So if anybody still has the energy too, they're going to be able to attend the Clemson basketball, which is more known for its football, but basketball should be fun. It's ACC basketball. And then on the third day, they head back through the mountains back into Seneca, where we're going to be welcomed. Seneca is home to the creation of moonshine. So we'll be welcomed to a grand party at the end, closing ceremony, where people will get to taste the different kinds of moonshine and just enjoy small town jazz music.
Well, it sounds like a heck of a lot of fun. Good food, I take it?
Yes, traditional to the area.
Wow. Wow. Is there a limit to the number of people you're going to allow to register this year?
300 people this year.
And how's registration going? I mean, I know it's a new event. I just found out about it. But are people starting to register?
Yeah, thank God they already started registering like 2 months ago. And we're pretty close to reach our number.
Very good. And so what's the website for people to go to find out more about it, to sign up? You've got some really cool things. You've got jerseys. The race packet is pretty nice, actually, as I noticed.
Thank you. The website is www.roadtitans300.com.
Well, you know, I wish I was up to it, but I got news for you. I'm not even close. So physically, no, I could sit behind this microphone and talk to you all day, but I certainly couldn't get on a bike and ride 30,000 feet of climbing in 3 days. I hope you guys have a great event. It sounds like fun. We're going to watch it. Get back to us when it's all over and tell us how it went. How's that?
All right. For those that are listening, if they accomplish this and gain that jersey that is the Road Titans 300 jersey, they're going to be very proud to wear it, because after they make it through this, they're going to want to take that home and enjoy that.
I am sure. RoadTitans300.com. John Michael and Jonathan, thank you so much. Have a great event.
Thank you.
All right.
Nice meeting you.
We'll talk again. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm ready.
Yeah.
Not to do that. But
can you imagine?
I didn't realize it was that much climbing. You know, when I looked at the website and I saw what was there, but I didn't realize there was that much climbing with it. It looks like a great event.
Well, as you scroll down on the website, you'll see all the graphs for each day.
One quick little tip. If you're not following on Twitter, follow them at RoadTitans300. And if you haven't registered yet, go ahead and follow them and check in your direct message box. There's a little special treat there for you.
Wow. Are you cashing in on it?
No.
No. Okay. Well, on that note, I think we're going to say bye-bye. How's that?
Yep.
Okay. We'll see you next week. And by the way, I'd just like to take a moment to say thank you for listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are now beginning year 5. We have finished 4 full years on the air thanks to you, our listeners. Thank you so much. And don't forget, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.